from KQED.
Hey there, everybody. It's that time again. From KQED Public Radio, this is Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer.
And I'm Marisa Lagos. And today on The Breakdown, she's one of the most powerful women in Sacramento whose name you might not even know yet. Anne O'Leary, self-described policy wonk, a veteran of Democratic politics, a friend of Bill and Hillary.
She worked in the Clinton White House and Hillary Clinton's campaign for president. Now she is chief of staff to Governor Gavin Newsom. Marisa, we have so many things we want to talk to her about.
What are we going
to
talk about?
We have a long list of things, but we're going to begin, as we do, by talking
to each other. To ourselves.
That's right. Actually, Anne is here, so she'll be witness to all this. But big decision this week in Sacramento. The national news, Governor Gavin Newsom deciding to suspend the death penalty to give reprieve to 737 inmates on death row. Huge news.
Huge. And I guess if you look back, the breadcrumbs were sort of there. He had been starting to talk about this more. But I think it came as a really big surprise here. And yeah, we both know it's national news because we both had to get up in the middle of the night different days and talk about it. But, you know, so he came out flanked by really like a who's who of Democratic lawmakers and constitutional officers.
In the rotunda, or just off the rotunda.
Right,
the
outside
State Capitol.
Pro Tem's office. And made really sort of deeply personal comments about kind of what brought him to this decision, including a case that both of his grandfather and his father had worked on, a wrongful conviction case with a mob alleged hitman who was not.
Yeah. And, you know, it's always when these, like, I remember you covered and I was in the city when he was mayor and he decided to allow same-sex couples to get marriage licenses in San Francisco. And there's always the initial reaction of the cynical media is, oh, he's doing this, you know.
Speak for yourself.
In that
Scott.
Case, it was to consolidate his support on the left, right? Because he had barely won just a few months earlier. And I think, you know, there was a fair amount of skepticism about this as well, not to mention some anger. We'll get into that as well. But, you know, I think, you know, you had a chance to talk to him this week after the announcement. And it was pretty clear, I think, that this was something that was pretty difficult for him to do and also pretty heartfelt.
Yeah. I mean, he talked, you know, to folks on all sides of this issue ahead of time, including victims' families who both support and oppose the death penalty. And I asked him specifically about that conversation because during that news conference, he said that one family in particular told him that it was his job to eradicate evil. And so I asked him kind of about what those conversations were like and what he told those families.
Yeah, I remember specifically that engagement that I said, I cannot imagine being in your position, and I am not going to for a second question it, and I completely respect your point of view, and I am not here to even debate that point of view. I'm tasked with a different question. The question being put on me is, how do I process the execution of 737 people, one person every day for 2 years, one person every week for 14 years?
And I thought that framing was really interesting, you know, and this idea of, you know, and obviously, he probably would not preside over the execution
of all
those people.
Well, yeah, I was going to say that was a little overly dramatic.
But it's the magnitude of it, right?
Right. I mean, certainly, if you take one life, it's got to be very difficult to preside over that. But there's 25 people, not 737, who have exhausted their legal appeals. But, you know, the point's well taken. But it was a little, I thought that was, you know, a little dramatic.
A little dramatic. Well, I thought it was interesting to hear him talk about sort of the difference between it as a theoretical, sort of philosophical discussion and when what he said was, you know, I got elected, we started transitioning, and I asked my legal team to brief me on this. And when they came back, you know, he said he thought maybe in the end of his first term that he might be having to make these calls about whether to oversee an execution and sign off on it. And they said, well, as early as April, those protocols might be ready.
Yeah, the lethal injection protocol was very close to being approved. And, you know, it's no secret, his predecessor, Jerry Brown, very much against the death penalty. I'm sure he would not have wanted to preside over an execution either. It would have been interesting. It is interesting that he didn't do what Governor Newsom did. You know, he could have given a reprieve, and he chose not to do that. Maybe he knew it wasn't really it wasn't a decision he had to make.
Right. I mean, I think in some ways he kind of ran out the clock on that,
right?
Oh, absolutely. And I think there's been accusations that he dragged his feet. But
well, also, let's not forget his first time as governor, the death penalty loomed large as well.
After
and so
that.
Maybe he didn't want to have a bookend there.
Yeah, but I also think that this speaks to the different styles of these two men. Again, you know, how sort of personally Newsom talked about this, not just about that that case that his father took on, but about going to death row and seeing somebody he knew from high school there, about having foster siblings that his mom had taken in who were not sentenced to death, but had, you know, had experienced the criminal justice system as men of color.
Bias.
And I think the issue of innocence, you know, and I think we should say there's a lot of people who are really mad right now about this. And
yeah,
you know,
there are. And that's totally understandable. At the same time, you know, there's this sense or this illusion, really, that capital punishment brings closure to families.
Or that
crime
it's been
victims.
Working. We haven't had an execution in 13
well,
years.
Well, right. And these families have to continually stay engaged with the legal system during the appeals process. You know, as they say, the leading cause of death on death row is old age.
Right.
People are dying because they're getting old, they're getting sick. Occasionally there's been a murder, you know, from by another prisoner. But so I think it is sort of a false promise. I certainly understand, you know, why someone would want to see the person who killed their son or their daughter or whoever put to death, you know, but when is that really going to happen?
I mean, yeah, and I think that is really the ultimate point is none of us, you cannot tell somebody how to grieve, and everybody is going to have a different point of view. I will say, and I know you've watched this issue for a long time, and we've both covered a lot of criminal justice things. I think it's interesting that the framing of victims is shifting, and that you're hearing more from the governor yesterday, from, you know, people on our air talking about the fact that there was a very vocal group of mostly middle class, you know, white parents who really drove a lot of the discussions around three strikes and some of those tough on crime laws. And there are a lot of people, especially of color, who I think experienced both sides of the criminal justice system, who are coming out, not just in this issue, but in some of the broader reforms and saying, hey, you know, we want to see it at the table too. And, you know, I think the next question obviously does become political. Does this go before voters in 2020 and what happens?
Exactly. Well, we want to talk about that and much more with our guests. So we're going to take a short break. And when we come back, our conversation with Governor Newsom's chief of staff, Anne O'Leary. You're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio.
Welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Marisa Lagos, along as always with Scott Schaefer. And today we're delighted to have with us a woman whose fingerprints are all over those policies and proposals coming out of Sacramento, especially ones affecting children. Anne O'Leary is Governor Gavin Newsom's chief of staff. Welcome to the breakdown.
Thank you so much. It's a delight to be here.
Thanks for coming in.
So your title's chief of staff. What does that mean? What do you do all day?
You know, it's a combination of dealing with the major policy issues of the day. So that's both things that are coming at you. So wildfires, crisis management, what's happening with our utilities, but also the positive agenda going forward. How do we make sure that we're driving that? In order to do that, you have to have an amazing team. I feel like I'm the team captain, and the team of, public policy is a team sport. So I have, really managed just a terrific group of people to make all that happen.
And is a day like 18 hours long usually?
It is often very long. Yeah, it starts really
early. You've worked for a number of politicians, Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton. How does Gavin Newsom compare in terms of his style, do you think?
You know, he's a very easy person to be around. He's really smart. He reads all the time. He's thinking all the time. He's always active, involved, and he's incredibly bold. I mean, we saw it here in San Francisco with same-sex marriage, but everything he does is how can we do as much good as fast as possible, but also with people coming with us. You know, he talked about the African proverb in his inaugural speech, which is, you know, if you want to go far, you'd go together, and if you want to go fast, you go alone, Maybe I got that.
Is it different than other politicians you've worked for? Does it feel different?
You know,
I mean, they must all feel different.
All feel different. You know, I worked for Hillary Clinton for nearly 20 years on and off. And so I could tell you what she was going to say before you said it. She said it. I knew her so well. And she was bold in her own ways, but, you know, from a different time in a different era in some ways. And so I think, you know, it's different.
Yeah.
You know, my impression of Gavin Newsom is that he's a lot more like Bill Clinton than like Hillary, you know, in the sense that he's very spontaneous. My hunch is that he comes into the office in the morning and you're not quite sure what he's going to want to do. I mean, he has a big set of interests, I would say.
He has a big set of interests. He's really ambitious about everything he wants to get done, but he has real ideas about how to do it. So one of the things, I'll just give you an example that he does, is I'll be having a staff meeting, we'll be planning out, and he'll just walk in unannounced and sit down and say, no, let's think about doing it this way. I want to be, you know, even more, do that sooner, do that faster, do that differently. I want to, you know, make sure I have people standing with me. me in this way. So he has a lot of opinions about how to get it done.
All right. I want to move on to you and your life, but because this is a good transition, I'm just curious. Like, I feel like he's had a pretty great reception in Sacramento, but I do think the one thing I hear from a lot of people up there is he wants to do so much. Like, is there a set of priorities? What can you actually get done? I mean, what would you say are the really sort of core things? Understanding you have to walk and chew gum in this job, you know, but is he trying to do too much?
I don't think he's trying to do too much, but I do think we have to be smart about how we prioritize and get things done. There's three things he's trying to do. One is that he's trying to address the cost crisis in California. You know, we know that about 60% of young people say they literally cannot afford to live in California. 60%, that's a lot. If we don't deal with the housing, healthcare, transportation, the cost issues, then we're going to lose people. The second big bucket is he really has this ambition of justice for all. And you saw that yesterday with the death penalty announcement. You see in his passion for safe drinking water. And then the third thing is he's very focused on effective government. How do we make sure that when we look at climate change and wildfires that we have working utilities?
That was a lot, though.
I'm really surprised.
That's a lot, but I got it. You know, I got it down.
I'm so surprised that none of the children's issues were in that list, because that's important to you, I know, as you worked for Hillary Clinton. And he's talked a lot about child care, parental leave, early childhood education. I mean, I'm surprised that's not in the top three.
You know, I think I probably should have expanded the first one. We talk about the cost crisis, but we also talk about it in terms of affordability and opportunity. And so there's a whole agenda regarding opportunity from cradle to career. And we are very focused on that. You know, I think part of it is that there's such great people we have working for us who are doing that every day. So part of it is how do you use his time versus how do we use our team's time? So we're trying to do both of those things well.
All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about you and your life. You grew up in Maine.
I did.
Your dad was head of the AFL-CIO there and sounds like a kind of larger-than-life figure.
He was a great Irishman who told a great story and a great joke. Every room he walked into, he had people laughing. But he was also just a really inspirational person. You know, walked picket lines with him when I was growing up at a time when a lot was changing in Maine. So I learned a lot from him.
And your mom, I think, was a social worker?
My mom was a social worker. So they really were, you know, kind of the spirit of public service and helping people and really had it in their core being and pass that on to me.
Was politics, I mean, it sounds like he brought you into at least union politics. Was politics something you thought you might go into?
I had an itch for it early on.
Really?
In part, what I saw when I was in high school, there were major strikes in the paper mills in Maine, and they didn't end well. In fact, actually, the paper mills permanently replaced the strikers, so all the union members lost their jobs.
Oh, wow.
And I saw communities devastated. I saw people lose their jobs. I saw young people, their parents literally not having any income, and it made a real impact on me. But I also, you know, grew up with a sister who had, you know, pretty serious mental health issues, and seeing the fact that she didn't get great service in our small town. Those things combined led me to really want to do more.
And you were instrumental in sort of putting the opioid crisis on the agenda. Did that have anything to do with your upbringing in terms of what you saw and what your dad talked about, your mom talked about?
You mean in the presidential campaign?
Yeah, I mean, I know it's into the future, but I just wonder, because I know up in that part of the U.S., there are a lot of problems with that.
It's really, during the Hillary campaign, I ended up doing roundtables all over New Hampshire on the opioid crisis. And, you know, it's a drug that really knows no income bounds, knows no geographic bounds, but it does end up in a lot of rural towns, and it's devastating. It is something that my family's experienced with my sister's problems. It's something that many families have experienced.
And I think you'd be hard-pressed to find someone in America right now who doesn't know somebody who has struggled with this.
So it's something that I think, you know, it's interesting because I think particularly in urban areas, we are obviously sitting here in San Francisco, you don't see it and feel it as much, but you get into the rural areas in California, it's just the same as it is in New Hampshire.
So did you come out to California first for school? Was that kind of the first draw?
No, my ex-husband's from here, so we came out together after we got married. And
You met him back east?
I met him back east in Washington. He grew up in Sacramento, and so we came out here when he joined the faculty at UC Berkeley.
And was that, what was that transition like? Because had you been in D.C. for a bit?
I had been in D.C. for about 10 years, but I actually came out here before I met him. I came out here on my own, and I went to Stanford. I got a master's in education policy. I'd been working in the White House, but at night I'd been volunteering for a program in D.C. that helped young people in the high schools who needed tutoring, and I was very inspired by some of the inequality issues that I saw in D.C. So I came out here to Stanford, got a degree in education policy. So I'd been familiar with the area, but it's really different than the East Coast out here. I've been here for 16 years now, and I now I'm a Californian. I've got California children, and I love it.
So you have two kids?
Two kids, yeah.
And they're, you said that earlier
sixth
we were talking.
Sixth grade and third grade, yeah.
And the same birthday.
And the same birthday tomorrow. Happy birthday to my children.
Good luck this weekend. No.
Thank
Wait,
you.
So let's go back, though, because you said you were in the White House. So how did that, like, how did you kind of enter the political world? This was after undergrad?
I did. So I went to undergrad in Massachusetts at Mount Holyoke College, a women's college. And then I got an opportunity to intern for Senator George Mitchell from Maine, who was the Senate Majority Leader at the time. My dad helped me get that internship. And then I didn't have any money. And so I couldn't really afford to have an unpaid internship. So after college, I actually started doing something that was before the internet. So I volunteered at the White House and I went in at 4 a.m. and I did newspaper clippings and handed them out to the West Wing folks.
What years did you do that? I'm just curious.
That was I graduated from college in 1993 and started volunteering that year.
So volunteering?
So I was volunteering in the White House because the internships, I couldn't afford to work during the day. I had to work.
Oh, I see.
So I would go from 4 a.m. until about 7 a.m. with the newspaper clippings, and then I'd go to my job. About a year later, they asked me if I wanted to apply for a paid job at the White House, and I got to do that.
So, sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, what's it like clipping all those like bad articles about your boss? And they hear, here's what they're saying about you.
Yeah, you know, it's so fascinating because it was such a different time. And I think sometimes, you know, I've taught law school in the past, and people are so surprised that, you know, that we grew up in a time when there was no internet, even in the White House. But we used to go and we'd get newspapers from all over the country and we'd look at them all, and you had to clip the major news articles and then everything about the president. And sometimes there were some pretty bad days, although it was 1993, so the early days were good.
So good, 96, 7, 8.
Yeah, when I came back after I got my master's in education policy, I came back to the White House, and those were darker days. I mean, it was definitely the second term was hard and lots of, you know, raw emotion in the country about what the president was doing and what we were trying to do.
How did you and other women on the staff during that era talk among yourselves about what was happening?
You know, it's so interesting because I've obviously reflected on it a lot, especially in recent years. And I just have to say it was such a different era. And it was also a time in which we felt so politically under attack and felt, obviously, the impeachment was going on, impeachment hearings were going on. One of my dear friends, a woman named Cheryl Mills, was the attorney who defended the president on the floor of the Senate. And she and I used to go running together every morning. And it was really, in some sense, I'm embarrassed to admit that I just saw it as a huge political attack on him. And I didn't really process the issues of the power dynamic, the sexual issues, until really recently when I thought, you know, my gosh, did I really miss this?
Well, you still see that. I mean, I think it's not uncommon to close ranks in politics.
Yeah.
You know, look at the Kavanaugh hearings. I think that, you know, people on either side of that sort of like retreated to their, you know, corners and didn't. Yeah.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer with Marisa Lagos. Our guest is Anne O'Leary. She's chief of staff to Governor Gavin Newsom. You know, you said that you hadn't processed that stuff until recently. And I'm wondering, was that before or after the presidential campaign with Hillary Clinton? Because that really was an issue during that time.
Yeah.
For a lot of women, right?
Right. Well, I mean, you know, for Hillary, you know, she's such a leader for women. You look at all the women who are running for president, and the fact of the matter is that there's multiple women running for president is such an extraordinary time in our history. You know, I was so proud of her. I was so proud of the work I did for her. I was so proud of the advocacy she did on gender equity. And I got the chance to run her transition, you know, hoping that she would be the first woman president. And it was such a time that I was so proud that certainly those issues came up, but it was more in the process of what could we do to really help, you know, right some of the wrongs of the past in terms of the Me Too movement.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that. So you were co-chairing her transition team. And my understanding is, I mean, like the rest of the country, you guys thought she had a pretty good shot of winning.
Yeah,
so
there was no plan B.
Yeah. So what was, I mean, how far down the sort of road had you guys started planning? And
I mean, there was talk that Joe Biden was going to be the Secretary of State. I mean, it had gotten that far?
Yeah, so there's a Presidential Transition Act. So actually both sides, both Trump and we, were in the same building, different floors, planning the transition 3 months in advance. We had about 20, 25 people on staff, and I was leading it up with a co-director. And we had definitely, you know, had a binder filled with our cabinet picks, and we had delivered it to her to, you know, evaluate and think about with us for the next day. We had all of our policy plans that we were translating from policies into implementation. So It was nothing short of devastation when we lost that night.
Did you? So if you guys were in the same building, was like Chris Christie upstairs or downstairs working?
Yeah, so Chris Christie was the chair, and then there was a guy named Rich Baggard was his executive director.
Were they working? Did you feel like you were further ahead of them?
You know, it's interesting because the way that the Presidential Transition Act works is that Obama's chief of staff would call us in regularly for meetings to make sure that giving briefings to both sides is part of the, you know, really responsibility of the government to make sure there's a smooth transition. So I got to know, you know, his team. But remember, Trump fired that team days after
and threw all that work
election.
In the garbage, right?
And threw all that work, which
Chris Christie's
really,
work.
You know, for whatever you think of Trump, I think that was definitely one of the worst mistakes for effective governing. So that was very disheartening.
So where were you on election night?
So I had struggled with whether I should just stay at the office, to be honest, and keep working because we were going to go from, you know, 20 people to about 1,000 employees the next day. But John Podesta, who is the chair of the campaign, said, come up. You're going to be, you know, when she becomes president, you're going to be one of the first people to brief her. You need to brief her on the transition. And plus, Anne, you've been doing this for 20 years.
Like, come celebrate.
Yeah. So I went up and I was there that night. I had gone early in the evening to be with some of our big supporters. It was a very, like, exciting and heady time. And then I went over to the convention center and things started looking strange. My friend Cheryl Mills was actually in with Hillary, and so I was calling her and trying to find out what was going on, and it just started looking really bad. John Podesta said, if it looks like we're going to tie, if there's a Bush v. Gore situation, you need to go back to D.C. and open the office. So I decided to actually get on a train to go back to D.C. in case we needed to open up the transition office. So I got to Penn Station at 3 a.m. By the time I got there, they had just called.
So you're all by yourself.
Gosh.
You know, it was interesting. A bunch of us ended up there. So Neera Tanden, who's the head of the Center for American Progress, a bunch of us ended up on that train, which was a pretty sad train to back to D.C.
Wow. But so, okay, so now you're in Sacramento and you're in this position that's like quasi politics and policy, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like you've really, I mean, thinking about the last 3 months of a campaign, that you were like deep in the policy, not on the political side. How's that transition been? Do you like the politics?
You know, I've been in politics, I've been at the intersection of politics, policy, and law for pretty much my whole career. So, you know, I've been in government, I've been on the campaign, I worked as a senior policy advisor on the campaign. So that part is not new at all. I feel like it's pretty natural in terms of the work that I'm doing. What is new is that I've never worked at state government. Although I've lived in California for some time, I really am new to Sacramento. So the part that I hadn't anticipated is just all the relationships, meeting people, making sure you get to know people, because part of politics is, you know, built on relationships.
Yeah.
So I've got a lot of work to do there.
So are you ready to like twist some arms in the legislature for that clean water deal or whatever?
I don't know about twisting arms. Right now, I'm just trying to meet people and really, you know, it's an exciting time. It's a great legislature and people really want to get work done.
So we talked at the top of the show about the death penalty. And tell us about the last week or so with the governor.
Yeah, like how did he tell you about that?
How did he tell you, and also meetings with families?
Yeah. So, you know, he's really been interested in this. He started thinking about it as he was getting close to the election before I joined. I joined him just after the election. And, you know, it's been deep in him for some time. And he's been anxious about the fact that we know that he would have to eventually maybe sign the warrant for a death to happen in California. So we started talking about it during the transition. But in the last week, as he realized that this court deadline was approaching with regard to the lethal injection protocol, that we would have to decide what we're going to file in court. And he didn't feel comfortable filing on behalf of lethal injection. And so we really started talking to him about all of the legal options over, you know, the last month, and came to where we did. But the last couple of days were incredibly emotional, probably more so than I thought. We met civil rights leaders who have, faith leaders who really have been working on this for so many years, you know, crying with tears in their eyes, thanking us. But we also met with victims' families, and it was, you know, gut-wrenching. The emotion was so raw and so hard. So I think it was not something he took lightly, but it was also not something any of us took lightly.
Were you nervous at all when he said, this is the path I want to take? Just about, you know, the ramifications and how big of a decision that is.
I know I wasn't nervous at all. I mean, The good thing is that I felt like we had such moral clarity and certainty about what he was doing that I wasn't nervous about that at all. I was wanting to make sure that we did it, you know, legally, the most legally sound way to do it, that we communicated it right, that we met with people who wanted to meet with us, that we reached out to law enforcement and families and civil rights leaders and faith leaders. So I wanted to get all that right. And I was nervous that we wouldn't have enough time to get all that right, but I wasn't nervous about what we did.
You know, I can imagine if you, after you pass big legislation that you're excited about, you go celebrate. And this is so somber. It's such a somber issue. Yeah. How did you mark it, you know, when it was done?
You know, one of the things that was so amazing is we have an incredible team. And, you know, I'm somebody who deeply believes in diversity. It's been really moving, you know, Catherine Lehman, Kelly Evans, who's our legal advisor and our deputy legal advisor, both African-American women. Justice Marty Jenkins is now our judicial appointments advisor. Anthony Williams, an African-American man, who's our legal secretary. Being there with them, Daniel Zangali, being them with there with all these people, it's been really powerful. So in some sense, we marked it by, you know, quoting Martin Luther King to one another. At one point, Daniel Zangali, who's very religious, you know, said a prayer. It's been a really kind of a moment where it's been somber, but it's been a really supportive network of people.
We're getting short on time. I want to ask you just like one question about 2020. We were debating whether or not to ask about that. Have you endorsed anybody, first of all?
I have not personally. The governor has
endorsed Kamala Harris. What kind of person do you think the Democrats need to win in 2020?
You know, I think that, first of all, I think that it's great so many people are in the race. You know, I think that we need to have people having feeling like there's some, but there's an alternative to Trump, and that the vision that we believe so much here in California, our values of inclusiveness and progressivity, are something that we can, you know, go forward on. You know, I also went through a race where, you know, gender bias is a real live issue in our country. Racial bias is a real live issue in our country. The Russians attacking us was a real live problem that we had in our campaign. I do not think that we have grappled with all of those things, and so I worry about them, and I hope we will.
So does that mean you think maybe it would be safer bet to nominate a man?
No, I think we got to go with a woman. I mean, I don't want to be that person who thinks that the safer bet is with a man. I want to believe that a Kamala Harris, that an Elizabeth Warren, that an Amy Klobuchar can be the president of the United States. And so I hope to be able to support the women candidates.
All right, one fun question. We hear you're a runner, hiker.
Yeah, well, I used to
run more than
that.
What do you do for fun?
I hike. I love hiking. In fact, I'm going to admit it. I went for a hike right before this because I just needed
to. Oh, good. In San Francisco? Where'd you go?
I went up in Oakland Hills. I stopped at my house and went for a hike.
Oh, good for you. That must be rare these days.
It is rare, so I thought I'd take an opportunity after that long week to just take a break for myself. Yeah.
Well, Anna O'Leary, thank you so much for coming in. We could have talked for another half hour, I'm sure, very easily, but thank you. We really appreciate
it. Thank you both so much.
That does it for this edition of Political Breakdown. It's a production of KQED Public Radio. You can subscribe to our Political Breakdown newsletter, by the way. It gets delivered every Tuesday. You get all of our personality. Marisa, do we have personality?
A little bit.
And analysis. I know we have that without having to hear our voices.
Subscribe at, I think you wrote that, kqed.org/newsletters. For today, our producer is Guy Marzorati. Our engineers are Katie McMurrin and Seal Muller. Vinny Tong's our managing editor. Ethan Lindsay is our executive editor. Holly Kernan's our chief content officer.
A lot of people work here.
Jesus. I'm Marisa Lagos. You can find me on Twitter. I'm at mlagos.
And I'm Scott Schaefer. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm ready. Wait for it. At Scott Schaefer.
No second C.
S-H-A-F-E-R.
See you guys next time.
Bye-bye.